Okay, good morning. How's everybody? Good morning. All right, so I'm also happy to be here with this fabulous panel, and I must say that Dr. Satcher and Larry were a couple of the first people who I interacted with when I came back to the great United States of America after years abroad. And my training is infectious diseases, and I'm going to talk to you about something that I've resisted for a long time, but finally came to realize is that violence really does behave like a contagious process, in fact, a contagious disease. And I'm going to take you through some of this because it allows us in public health to have specificity, but more importantly, because it's actually where the data shows it to be. I first had wind of this by looking at graphs and charts and maps, and I just can't resist it anymore. Now, this fits into the idea that this is a health problem. I usually don't say public health problem because the larger community doesn't exactly know what that is, but they all know what health is. And if, for those of us who are thinking about these communities, you have to ask yourself the question, what else could this be than a health problem? Tell me what else this could possibly be. What else is it? And, I mean, in the context of thinking about communities and mental health and emotional health and trauma, and the fact that it's the cancer and heart disease of young people. I mean, who have we abdicated responsibility or care of this problem to? For how long? Why? This is first and last a health problem. Now, beyond that, this is contagious. It meets the definitions of contagious, both medical and standard dictionaries, which means what? That it's transmissible. It means what? Is that the greatest risk factor of violent event is a preceding violent event. Think retaliation, think gang war, think war. And think soccer riot, think outbreaks of genocides or anything. It's like flu. The greatest predictor of flu is a preceding case of flu or colds. And the same thing is true for violence. Likewise, it meets all of the definitions, which I'll show you, not all of them, for disease. That is to say, there are characteristic signs and symptoms causing morbidity and mortality. Did you notice that the Centers for Disease Control has a violence prevention unit? The World Health Organization has a violence. It shows up in hospitals. This is a disease state. It meets the definitions. It meets criteria that epidemiologists and infectious disease people use. The Institute of Medicine has now really formally adopted this way of thinking about the problem, collecting the research. I will show you a whole bunch of stuff about transmission. And then most importantly of all, if you treat it as a contagious process, you get results. We've seen 40 to 70% drops in shootings in neighborhoods in Chicago, 30 to 50% drops in neighborhoods in Baltimore. There have been three independent evaluations of the treatment of violence as a contagious process, which reliably show reductions in shootings and killings, not bullying, in shootings and killings. This is now showing up also in Puerto Rico, in South Africa, and in London, reductions from between 50 and actually 80% using a new method, which I'll be able to show you. So this is a health problem nested within a contagious disease issue. These are the cities that are now treating violence like a contagious disease, and these are the countries or cities within countries that are now treating violence in this way. Did I say this is a health problem? Now, the health sector, fortunately, is now stepping up, and there's now increasingly a number of health departments that are taking lead, not on just the young children stuff, but on the epidemic control. So when you see all the stuff on the news about children being mourned and so on, and you see this other sector involved with this, you know, I mean, why? And with these kinds of responses, the dungeon response, be reminded this is an entirely wrong diagnosis of this issue. The problem has been misdiagnosed. As we in medicine and health have done over and over and over again throughout the history of man, this is plague, which we used to bring people into this kind of a circumstance. We blamed the people, didn't want to go in their neighborhoods, put them in dungeons, dragged widows around the moat. Why the heck were we doing this kind of crazy stuff? We didn't know what was going on. because it was invisible what was going on. In this case, these were microorganisms. In the case of violence, it's the invisible nature of the way the brain processes violence in cortical ways, in dopamine-mediated ways, invisibly copying it. The problem of violence has not been solved, not because of lack of money or lack of caring. It was strategically stuck, just as these other problems were stuck, doing the same things, complaining about the same things, not seeing it for what it really was. However, when these other problems, typhus, malaria, plague, whatever, got determined to be what they really are, we developed, by science, we developed new understandings, a whole new set of strategies that we were not using before, a whole new set of methods that we were not using before. And as it happens, some of these, including early detection, interruption of transmission, case finding and treatment, are the same categories that we are now using to reduce violence, and it's working likewise. So, what is the scientific understanding? Let me just show you the three things. Here is the definition of contagious. It means it can be transmitted. Violence. Now, on the left, people in a housing project, African American, poor nutrition, massive poverty, very limited exposure to violence. On the right, exposure to violence, same stuff, controlled, poverty, crowding, bad nutrition, African American, same housing project. The risk factor of violence is the primary risk factor for violence. That's what epidemiologically characterizes something as infectious, is if it's a risk factor for itself. Not only that, it's dose-dependent. High exposure, intermediate exposure. Exposure to it causes itself. Exposure to colds causes colds. Exposure to flu causes flu. Exposure to TB causes TB. Can be later. Doesn't have to be immediate, and not in every person. Not everybody will get a cold if there's a cold in the room, because there's immunity. Disease definition, characteristic signs and symptoms, causing morbidity and mortality, a change in function, we can characterize it. Hence, it's contagious disease, it's a contagious disease. These are the three population characteristics of every single contagious disease. They're the only ones. Fits it. Clustering. Here's cholera. Here's violence. Epidemic curves, standard epidemic wave. This is cholera, secondary wave, new susceptibles, newly exposed. These were refugees came into the camp, so they became exposed secondarily. Forget the reasons, there's the curve. Violence, typical epidemic wave, secondary wave. People who were not exposed becoming secondarily exposed as they were susceptible. In this case, the reason is that they were found. They were hiding, they were found. Same epidemic patterns. And then the third thing is transmission. Like I've said, flu causes flu, colds, colds, TB, TB. Violence. By the way, being exposed to someone with a stroke does not cause you to get a stroke, more likely. Being exposed to someone who has diabetes does not more likely cause you to get diabetes, but this one does. Now, transmission also occurs across syndromes. So if you're exposed to community violence in your community, not only are you more likely to do community violence, by far, the exposure, by the way, is witnessing, observing, or trauma, but you're more likely to commit suicide or do family violence. Exposure to violence in your home, more likely to do several other types of violence too. Child abuse, not only more likely to do child abuse, but to do other forms of violence as well. How's this working? And if you're exposed to war, not only are you more likely to be involved in war, but you're more likely to do violence in your home. Think about this for a minute. You're exposed as a child to being abused. Why would you abuse your own child? You know how bad it was. Why would you do that? Something's been transmitted. You've been exposed to war. Israeli-Palestinian, Palestinian-Israeli. I can see violence. Why? To the other side. Why in your own community? Why in your home? Something's been transmitted. Same disease, different syndromes. We even know something about how it's transmitted, whereas cholera comes in through the mouth. The intestine processes it. It's not passive. It does certain specific things, no time to discuss. Violence comes in primarily this way. The brain does certain specific things. We know somewhat of what these are. I don't have time to go through it. It's summarized in the Institute of Medicine proceedings. Some of it is cortical. Some of it is pain center. Some of it is limbic. So this is how behaviors are formed, in case you were wondering. It's cortical. It's unconscious. It's invisible. It's not thought through. It just happens for other mammal species as well, and birds. And then we follow what others, what we think others expect of us. These is dopamine-mediated and pain center-mediated. And then lastly, trauma causes problems to the limbic system. And then you get this, and then you get this. How fortunately, though, we know how to reverse epidemics, and that's what we're doing at Cure Violence by doing these three things. That's all you need to do. And so you interrupt transmission, you find the other people. Here's an interruption of transmission done by violence interrupters. You have to find the other people who were exposed, especially those who are highest risk, and start to get them effective behavior change treatment, 6 to 24 months. And then you do something about shifting norms. Here's the program, mapping, new categories of workers, interrupters. On the right, all characteristics of workers and the training. We're in our third version of the training now. These are professionals. We've got a couple of these guys in the room. Maybe more. Yeah. Then preventing future transmission, outreach workers. They work with the highest risk selected by epidemiologic criteria, and they also have a whole set of training and support, supervision, et cetera, and then the work on shifting norms, which we basically borrow a lot from some of the ways that norms were changed in Uganda for sexual behavior, which is a much, much harder behavior to change. So this is a system, specialized workers. These are the types of workers. Every epidemic has specialized workers, a measles epidemic, an AIDS epidemic. There's new kinds of workers. There's now thousands of interrupters, thousands of behavior change agents, hundreds of community coordinators, and hospital responders around the world. The results of this, the first neighborhood in which this was tried, it was the worst police district in the United States, West Garfield Park, the year 2000, 67% drop in shootings and killings. The funders said, do it again, please. And the next four neighborhoods had an average of 45% drop. Here's the response. It's been maintained to 2013 in this neighborhood and several others. Here's the first six neighborhoods are all on the left. Three sets of controls shown on the right. Average of 45% drop. Everything statistically powerful. The next eight neighborhoods, the next four neighborhoods. Before and after hotspot densities. There have been three independent evaluations. The interrupters are able to get up to 100% drops in retaliations in the settings of murder. This is also occurring in Honduras and in Cape Town now. This is a summary. You can go to the website, Cure Violence, for more information and for more of this data. The Baltimore results, 30 to 50% drops in shootings and killings. This is being picked up a little bit by the popular media. Some of you know that there's been a movie made that's around the Chicago work. Places using it, Puerto Rico, South Africa, Kenya election. We've just come back from doing some training on the Syria-Turkish border. We've been working in Iraq and Basra for 5 years. So this is a health problem. This allows us to shift our thinking from the medieval. This is intentional medieval script on the left. All of this awful thinking, this incredibly medieval, moralistic ideas, and shift this to a more modern view of this as a contagious behavior, which is what science and data show. We can now interrupt events, change behaviors, and shift norms. And this is the new language. Whenever you hear the word criminal or gang or anything like that, think about who are these people who are using these words. This is the real words of the future that the media needs to be trained as well in solving this problem. So there's a new understanding of a health problem, contagious. It meets all kinds of definitions, every definition, every criteria. Institute of Medicine is validating. The treatment is working. Health sector is now stepping up. We've got about five or six health departments. Every health department that has a problem now needs to get engaged. There are specific roles that are on our website. The health department needs to do the epidemic control. The trauma centers need to do the preventing relapses and preventing retaliations. And there's roles for all of these other sectors. So with the health sector now stepping up finally, we can begin to apply the science, this is a system, and put violence into the past as well. Thank you very much.
I don't know about you, but it's great to listen to a presentation like this one and feel optimistic that it's really something that can be done. I'd ask that you give the panel another round of applause. Now, I scan the room. I don't see a microphone in the audience, so we'll have to be loudly projecting your questions and concerns and comments. So just please stand, and I'll try to repeat them to make sure everybody can hear you. Yes, indeed. Anyone want to comment on this? Oh, I'm sorry. The audience member mentioned someone who was around for a while doing tremendous work, Deborah Prothro Stith, and asked what's happening with her, where is she doing, what's happening with her work?
I'm having dinner with her tonight, so I'll let her know your comment. She is co-chair with me and Billy Weiss of the Unity Project. She's not working full-time any longer in violence prevention, but it's among her deepest commitments, and the work she's done is still amazingly relevant.
If you've not read her work, I strongly encourage you to Google it, find the books that she's written. It's tremendous work. No Violence is No Accident, is that the latest one?
Yeah. And she was also one of the ones initially funded by the CDC.
Dr. Satcher saying she was one of the initial ones funded by the CDC to do this work on violence prevention.
Injury Prevention Center.
I saw a hand over here. Yes, ma'am. Essentially, the question is the role of economic development and violence prevention, and how the panelists feel about that as a very valid tactic to reduce violence in America and around the world. Who's first? I know everybody wants to speak on this one. Yeah, I think so. Just go to the microphone.
Well, I'm anxious to see what Garrett's going to say in terms of how it fits his model, but I think poverty breeds violence in many ways because of the great insecurity that goes along with it. That doesn't mean that everybody who's poor is going to be violent, but I think in communities where there's poverty, there are a lot of factors feeding a violent epidemic. So I think the reduction of poverty, as Michael Marmot said yesterday, ought to be a priority on the agenda of all countries in this world.
No one can possibly be against economic development or poverty. Poverty, I am not aware of anyone who has economically developed their way out of violence. However, economic development has followed cessation of violence in communities and in countries. The way that Paul Collier is thinking, who wrote the book The Bottom Billion, who was the World Bank's leading economist. By the way, you should be aware, the World Bank and several of the international agencies, international development agencies, have resisted this topic of violence for all of these years, thinking that they could economically develop their way out, and have learned that they haven't been able to do that. So Collier actually has these four reasons that keep what he calls the poverty trap. And a couple of them are things you can do nothing about, like being a landlocked country. But one is that he calls, and another is corrupt leadership. And the other is having this resource issue, being resource rich, which feeds the... But the fourth, and the one that he is now talking most about, is reducing the violence. In other words, the grass can't grow if there's fire going on. So that's my thing about whether you should do it at the same time, of course. Whether you should do A and B, of course. Of course. Yeah. I think we recognize Howard Spivak here.
Yeah.
Howard Spivak, by the way, is director of violence prevention at CDC. He's also, Ottawali just mentioned, Deborah Protos-Stitt's book, Violence is No Accident, and Howard is the co-author with Deborah of that book and one of my favorite colleagues and mentors over the last many years. I did want to say a couple of things. One is violence is an equity issue. And a health equity issue. And in order to make communities thrive, violence and education are probably the two central things that can fundamentally change communities, and in fact then are so successful that they lead to gentrification problems that we also have to solve, because as communities get safer, then a lot of people will move into those communities, pushing other people out. There's no question there's an interplay, and it's kind of been taken for granted for years and years that when there's an economic downturn that we have greater levels of violence. The last couple of years, it's the first time we really haven't seen that, where despite an economic downturn, most cities have actually been improving their violence rate a bit. I'm not sure exactly why that is. I think, you know, the work we've done with Unity with cities around the country, the work the mayors have done, I think we all represent a cross-section of the kinds of things that are changing that. As I say, we're increasingly knowing what to do, and that's starting to filter out throughout the country. But in my mind, there's no question that giving people jobs, improving the economic climate, in and of itself will not eliminate violence, but is a very, very important contributing factor. That's why in the story I told, the economic development director must step up. You know, we asked the port director in Oakland not just questions about the port, but we asked the port director questions about jobs for people in Oakland. We must have jobs as part of the solution.
Tipping point for violent prevention will reach
But those who couldn't hear, the basic question really is, at what point do we reach the tipping point where we've now stepped over the line and things begin to change dramatically? Who wants to go first? And everybody again. David?
I didn't stand up because I have the answer to your question, but I think it's like, you know, will we know when we've reached the tipping point, I guess, and how long will it take? And I don't know the answer to that. The violence epidemic of the 80s was interesting because it was associated with several things. It was associated, and in public health, of course, we don't always know cause, but we start with looking at associations. And just like violence is associated with poverty, but they're both associated with something else, I think is what we're saying. And certainly in the 80s, crack cocaine was big, and it was cheap. And so people, and of course, people sold it on the streets, especially people who had been poor in the past, dropped out of school, sold crack, became involved in gangs to get crack cocaine. So the interconnection between poverty and drugs and violence is beyond question. But I do believe and I agree that we need to continue to do research. The one thing Gareth said that I'm not quite clear I understand is that we don't need more money when all of the progress that we made in infectious disease, we funded research in infectious diseases. We were able to support research. Smoking, we were able to support research so that there could be more and more reports on smoking and health. That's the one thing I don't quite get, is how you can separate research from the progress that we've made in public health, whether it's dealing with infectious disease or whether it's dealing with violence. I don't get that, Gary.
Yeah. Let me touch on three things. So I didn't mean that money isn't relevant.
Okay.
What I was saying is that the principal reason why one way of looking at the possible reason why this field has not progressed more is that it's actually been stuck in terms of the strategies that have been used. And this has been, I mean, when I was at World Health, I learned this when I was running this group called Intervention Development, and we did summaries. We commissioned contracts to do summaries of 20 areas. I mean, family planning, diarrheal disease, pneumonia, et cetera. 20 diseases, and we were trying to figure out responses to the AIDS epidemic. What are we going to do? What's going to be the strategy to AIDS? Let's review these fields. And what really knocked me over were two things that we learned from the summary of these summaries. One is that behavior change occurs very fast, not slow, when you get the strategy right. Howard is nodding his head yes. Thank you. And the other is that fields got stuck for 20 years or 40 years. And if there were time, I could, you know, I mean, diarrheal, malaria was stuck because people were trying to get rid of the mosquito forever and ever and ever. You know, think about the guns here. I mean, they're just here. They stopped trying to get rid of the mosquito and went into doing bed nets. They stopped trying to do just water and sanitation, but went into ORT. And so these problems, I mean, it's not to not do the others, but the strategies got shifted. And so the reason there weren't progress in a lot of these other problems, family planning has a very interesting story, is not that the people didn't care, it was that the strategy was not right, the scientific understanding was actually not right. And so that's more fundamental. Everyone's banging their head, saying the same things instead of seeing it clearly. On the tipping point thing, there's two tipping points in the way that we're thinking about this problem. One is, and it relates to the question of money, one is, when are we going to fundamentally shift, that is to say, the tip, to how we're dealing with this problem? When are we going to tip from thinking about this as bad people to thinking about this as acquired, learned behavior? Where are we going to stop thinking about this as something that punishment is to solve, or every problem on earth needs to be solved until you can do it, to going at it directly? So when are we going to shift to a health approach? That's the first tipping point. Then the other tipping point is the norms themselves. And that has to do with very intentional work towards shifting norms, which we haven't really spent enough time talking about how to do. But obviously in health, as Dr. Satcher pointed out, we kind of know how to shift norms. I mean, not only were, when I was in medical school, a third of us were smoking while we were watching angiograms. And so we know how to shift norms, whether it's eating, exercise, sexual behavior, eating behavior. So those are the two tipping. Yeah.
But we learn how to shift norms around smoking and health with research.
Yeah. I'm not
that's what the Surgeon General report, the education about things that we've learned from research. I just don't want to feel like we're pitting one against the other.
Definitely not.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I wanted to add to this, too, because Prevention Institute is really founded on learning from one field and applying it to others. And I worked on the country's first multi-city no smoking laws, and also our organization ran Strategic Alliance, which was California's attempt, one of the first in the country, to shift the understanding of eating and activity behavior from individual responsibility to corporate and government and policy. Which I think we've been pretty successful at. I think it's a great question, but I would probably shift it, and I think it's what we're getting at here, from when are we going to reach the tipping factor to how do we reach the tipping factor. And I've been thinking about that as this conversation has been going on. One of the things I want to add to it, because what's been said already is very, very important, is a picture I showed earlier, which said we need to get the different fields of violence prevention to coalesce into one movement. So if we're talking about people shooting themselves and the trauma from suicide, the people who work on suicide prevention, and I know them, are not here. You know, if we're talking about violence against women, the people who have worked effectively on the Violence Against Women Act, for the most part, are not here. If we're talking about child abuse, if we're talking about trafficking, these are all interrelated problems. Many of these problems in different ways involve guns. They involve the same people. They involve people making profits unconscionably. And we all need to build a movement, a counter movement, which very strongly says we're not going to accept it anymore. I want to point out, even with tobacco, in one generation, there are now only 12% of adults who smoke in California. That's how quickly this changes. And as everyone's nodding, we can change norms and behaviors and cultures very, very quickly. At the same time, that's still a horrible problem. It's particularly a horrible problem among young people of color. It hasn't gone away. We've reached the tipping fact, but we haven't solved it. We need to come together aggressively and hurriedly. And exactly how long that's going to take depends on all of us raising our voices at the unconscionable way that this is being dealt with right now.
I want to say something about norms. We didn't really have a chance to talk about how norms change. Norms don't only change because of laws. You may notice that you're not smoking, others aren't smoking in some people's homes now, where the police aren't really coming in. The laws and theory. What's changed is what you think your friends expect of you. That's fundamentally the principal driver of behavior. That's why I wore this. I thought you expected this of me. That's why you're sitting the way you are and no one is standing on his feet and dancing. You're all confined to what you think the others are expecting of you, which is the same thing is what people are doing in the neighborhoods who are shooting. They're doing what they think their friends expect of them. It's the unconscious force. So that's why people such as U.S. and others who are involved in the neighborhoods can shift what they think their friends or they think the others think. And that's when the norms start to change. You see what I'm saying? The principal driver of whether a mom breastfeeds is whether she thinks the other moms do it. The principal determinant of whether someone is accountable, whether they think their friends do it. The principal determinant of whether someone is going to use violence, whether they think. And so it's that's the shift. It's community-based work that is in put in with intention and in the system.
So I think these gentlemen have the conversation handled. They have been having this conversation fruitfully or not for a long time. And I have to catch a plane, but I did want to end on a hopeful note. I think, and we discussed this a little bit yesterday, but, you know, much of this will change only when the research dollars flow and when laws change and when policies change, and that in large extent will happen when politicians change their mind about this issue. And politicians tend to be a lagging indicator of where the public is. And the public is in a very different place from where it was a year ago. That has not yet translated to policy or legal change, but it will, and it's starting to already. In places like Colorado and Delaware, we passed some of the broadest background check laws in the country. The CDC, we think, will start getting some money and the go-ahead to start doing this research again. So this is like a cruise ship. It turns very slowly. Whether it ends up being the Titanic or not is in large part whether we can convey the different public attitude to members of Congress and persuade them that it's okay to do this and the gun lobby is not going to take them out of office than it was a year ago. But the hopeful note I leave you on is the state of Washington, which is following a pattern that my home state of Colorado set after the Columbine shooting, when there was widespread agreement that this was basically a background check problem. The kids there had gotten a friend to buy them a gun at a gun show, and it later sort of came out through testimony that if they had not been able to find somebody to do that, they would not have gone and bought the gun themselves. This is something that's called the gun show loophole. You can go to the gun show, buy from a private seller, no background check, which we discussed earlier. Colorado legislature refused to close the gun show loophole. They wouldn't even take a vote on it because some of them were a wholly owned and operated operation of the gun lobby. So a group of businessmen led by a Republican businessman who is still active in that state decided they would circumvent the legislature and go direct to the state, and that's what they did. They put it on the ballot, and that passed by a 70-30 margin. Colorado just finished the job by closing the rest of the private sale loophole. No matter what kind of gun, no matter who you buy it from, you've got to go to a dealer and sell. So people in Washington are doing the same thing. They're going to bypass a recalcitrant legislature and put a universal background check bill on the ballot, and I think they're going to win. But here's the real good news. Generally speaking, people have no idea what the gun laws are, and they think they're much stricter than they are. This includes NRA members, 48% of whom, in a poll by Frank Luntz, think that everybody has to get a background check, even though we know up to 40% of transfers don't require one. Why? Because most law-abiding people buy their guns from licensed dealers where they get a background check. Today, in the state of Washington, a poll just showed that 86% of people in that state know that if you're going to go to a licensed dealer, you get a background check, and if you want to avoid it, you should go to a private seller somewhere else. 86% of people understand something that just, you know, less than, I guess about a year ago, most NRA members who are semi-experts on guns did not even know, which tells me that an enormous period of public education has gone on that has been very effective, and that people know much more, and that when people know more, as people in this room know better than anyone else, they will be more inclined to do the right thing. And with that, I'm off to my flight. Thank you so much for having me, and hope you continue the conversation.
We are running out of time. Perhaps this is a very, 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 very short question or comment. Do we need to close? Any response?
Right now.
Right now. actually, it leads into a very brief statement about closing the session. First, I wanted to thank the co-organizers, Elena Ong, and I'll get this pronounced correctly, Kushdeep Mahotra, Selena Smith, Sarah Garrow, and Peggy Timothy. And that is, we've been talking for the past couple of days within APHA at this convention about a movement, about engagement, about involvement, about taking a stand. I said during my talk, you know, do something, anything, take a stand for something, be about building a process and a movement. And everybody in this room is a part of the organization in some way or another. You're in different sections, different caucuses, different SPIGs, different interest groups. It's really time for this issue to be a major issue for our organization, and the opportunities for advocacy and support an encouragement to do the right thing around this issue. So when you leave here, you shouldn't just go back to your university, your city, whatever, and be about the rest of the business that you've been doing, but take a stand on this issue. Be about organizing for research and advocacy and education and shifting norms that have been discussed here this morning. I want to thank you for your attention, and I would be happy to give you another round of applause as great panelists, and wish you well for the rest of the conference.